Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today's show is a thematic show. It's all about women, the oppression of women, looking at where that oppression comes from, and talking about how only revolution can end the oppression of women. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to a segment from a film of a talk given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, back in the fall of 2012. And the film is called B.A. Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. And we're going to be listening to the section called The Oppression of Women, Bound Up with This System, A Driving Force for Revolution. And opening the show up, we're going to be talking about a very special film, a film that I saw up at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, and it's called After Tiller. And since the assassination of Dr. George Tiller in Kansas in May 2009, there are only four American doctors left who openly provide third trimester abortions. After Tiller paints a complex, compassionate portrait of these physicians who have become the new number one targets of the anti-abortion movement, yet they continue to risk their lives every day to do work that could end up having them killed by some fascist fanatic, work which they believe is profoundly important for their patients' lives, and for that reason, these doctors put their lives on the line day in and day out. Now, I saw this film when I was up at Sundance earlier this year, and I got a chance to talk with one of the co-directors of the film, Martha Shane, as well as with two of the doctors that are featured in the film, Dr. Leroy Carhart and Dr. Warren Hearn. So let's take a listen to this interview now. Here, I'm here at Sundance where I saw the recent world premiere of the film After Tiller, a film which tells the story of Dr. Tiller, somewhat his story of his life, but also the story of his assassination. Dr. Tiller was assassinated by one of the rabid, fascistic, anti-abortion forces back in 2009. And this film gets into the legacy of Dr. Tiller, his life, but also, more importantly, I think, even in a certain sense, is the people who were inspired to carry on with Dr. Tiller's work. And that was in particular in performing late abortions. And joining me here at Sundance to talk about the film and about Dr. Tiller and about their own lives and work are Dr. Leroy Carhart and Dr. Warren Hearn. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us on your program.
Why don't we start off by telling people a little bit about Dr. Tiller. You guys knew him. You were very close to him. And obviously, he inspired you. And you guys also, you had a very close back and forth relationship. And in a lot of ways, he changed your lives, I think, in terms of what you are doing now, what you have carried on with. Tell people about Dr. Tiller, because at the most, what they know is what the mainstream media puts out, what was put out when he was killed, and which really didn't tell his story and doesn't tell, as you stretch it out, doesn't tell the story of you guys either, of the doctors who perform late abortions. So why don't you tell me a little bit, tell the audience a little bit about Dr. Tiller, who he was.
Well, George was a family practice physician, and he originally had joined the military, the Navy, the Barry plan. He had to go in and serve his 2 years, and he wanted to come out and become a dermatologist. That was what his life's goal was. But during his tour in California, his father and his mother and brother and his brother's wife were all killed in a plane crash. They were going on vacation to Canada. George came home to close the practice and realized that there was a need for physicians in Wichita at the time, and he started just becoming a family practice doc. There wasn't a family practice specialty at that time, but he just started doing general medicine. And through the course of his general medicine, he found out that he never knew that his father was one that was performing, quote, illegal abortions within his practice. George never thought he would do it until he kept getting begged by his own patients that they really needed the service. And I guess he eventually found out about a patient that his father had refused to do the abortion on, and she had gone on, had someone else do it, a friend, and she eventually died, which is why his father had gotten into it. So he started doing abortions in 1970 is when it was, 3 years before Roe v. Wade. And I think, and I don't know the progression of how he became doing late-term abortions. I didn't start doing abortions until 1988, and it was really not George that got me into it. It was Dr. Hearn. I had done abortions in medical school in the 69-70 time with Marshall Klavan in Philadelphia, and Warren had and as far as I'm concerned, still has the most concise book about how to be an abortion doctor that was ever published. And I know NAF has done more since, and if you're teaching in a medical school, it's a great book. But if you're going to go out in the country and perform abortions, Dr. Hearn's book is the Bible, in my belief, okay? So that's how before I started, I bought his book. I think I read it 10 times before I got to Pittsburgh. And by the time I got to Pittsburgh, I think I knew as much, theoretically, not hands-on, but I knew more about abortion than some of the people that were training me. And I thank you for that, Warren.
Thank you.
I met George at my very first NAF conference, and I think I met Warren there the same time. NAF is the National Abortion Federation, and they had annual conferences, and this was in May of 1988. I started doing abortions April the 1st of 1988, and George did a presentation at that meeting. I think it was called From Spheres to Sports to Ultrasound. He was getting into to bringing ultrasound into the definition of how the pregnancy of a woman. And it was originally they were fruit, and then they became basketballs, softball-sized uterus. And George was using ultrasound. And in that conference, he asked who was providing ultrasounds, who was doing them full-time with their patients. And there were only four of us that raised their hand, and I believe you were one of the four, but I could be mistaken about that, but I know there were only four of us at that time that were doing ultrasounds on every patient. And so he had just said, well, if you want to talk to me afterwards, why don't the four of you come up? Well, I went up, and the first thing George said to me is, you're wearing cowboy boots, why? So we talked about that, and George was wearing cowboy boots, and that was the beginning of our friendship. How he got into doing the late terms, which I hate that expression, and thank you for letting me say it, I'm sorry. The later abortions, I like to call them third trimester abortions, or in my literature, the way I describe them is advanced gestation abortions, because that's really what they are. There's no, late term to the antis mean the moment after conception. It's too late to have an abortion then. So that's all he was. George was a very, very dear friend. I called him. He said, he at that time said, if you ever have a problem with a patient, if you just want to talk to somebody about something, if you're just upset and need somebody to bounce something off of, here's my numbers, call me. And we did. We talked probably at least monthly from that time on, and very occasionally, and sometimes every week, and a couple of days a week sometimes. I started to work for him in 1997 because he wanted to start backing off his practice. He was tired of working every day, every week, and he wanted to do it. He had another doctor working with him from Florida at that time who was getting ready to retire, and so he wanted me to come in, and then we were going to alternate eventually. And that still was, he wanted less and less, so we finally ended up with the three of us, and we each worked 1 week, and he was there most of the time. Well, he was there all the time training us, and then as he became more comfortable with us doing the later procedures, he spent less and less time in the clinic.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is an interview I did at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year about the documentary film After Tiller. This film tells the stories of the remaining four doctors in the country who continued to do third trimester abortions after the assassination of Dr. George Tiller by a Christian fascist anti-abortion fanatic in 2009. In the first part of the interview, I'm talking with Drs. Carhart and Hearn, two of the abortion providers featured in the film. The second part of the interview is with Martha Shane, who, together with Lana Wilson, co-directed the film After Tiller. Dr. Hearn, what about you?
Well, I think that this film is remarkable and outstanding and important because it, for the first time ever, it allows the doctors to speak and to express their thoughts about what they're doing and why they're doing it. That is unique. It is unprecedented. The pro-choice movement has really taken the doctors for granted for the last 40 years and really not placed any value on the role of the doctors and their point of view. There have been occasional exceptions to that, but that's the general rule. Doctors are regarded as technicians to be seen and not heard, and preferably not seen. So I think this is an important film from that perspective. I think that a sincere effort to allow the point of view in the lives of the physicians to be seen in their interaction with the patients. It certainly gives the patients opportunity to express their point of view, and that's incredibly important. the interaction between the doctors and the patients, the guts of what we're doing, it's the essence of what we're doing. It's pretty far separated from the abstract discussion of talking heads on national TV, where we see that the importance of your opinion about abortion is in inverse relation to your knowledge about the subject, which means the doctors who do abortions, who are experts, have not been part of that discussion. I did my first abortion in 1971. I was involved in the pro-choice movement for quite a while before that, back in the 60s. And I was working in Washington, D.C. in a program for a national program for family planning by the federal government. I was in charge of program development and evaluation. This is under the Nixon administration. And Nixon, mountebank as he was, supported reproductive freedom in very important ways. And so I was working in the Office of Economic Opportunity, the so-called poverty program, War on Poverty, and my job was to help community programs start family planning programs to help prevent unwanted pregnancies. And so I was very much involved with that, and I was invited in 1971 to visit a clinic in Washington, D.C. preterm and to perform abortions, and that's where I did abortions for the first time. And then I was invited to come back to be a consultant, and I did that, and I did some more abortions there in 1972. I didn't really plan to practice clinical medicine because I'm an epidemiologist. I'm trained in public health. But in 1973, the Roe versus Wade decision came down, and I was there when it was argued in 1972 or 71, first time, by Sarah Weddington and Margie Pitts Hames. So I was very much involved in that whole activity and understanding it from a public health point of view. But then in the fall of 1973, some people asked me to help form a nonprofit abortion clinic in Boulder, Colorado. It was the first freestanding nonprofit abortion clinic in Colorado. Colorado, of course, had the first abortion reform law in 1967, and so Colorado was already a leader in that respect. But I thought that I would do that for a year or so, then go back to school and work on my PhD in epidemiology. Well, by the end of that first year, when the people running the clinic abolished my job as medical director, they wanted me to continue, but they didn't want anybody in charge of anything. But I decided at that point that doing abortions was the most important thing I could do in medicine. And so when I left that clinic, I opened my own practice as Boulder Abortion Clinic. This is 1975. And I immediately started doing early second trimester abortions because I developed a technique and some instruments for doing that. Within a few years, I was doing second and third trimester abortions in the early 80s. And Dr. Tiller and I became acquainted at one of the National Abortion Federation meetings, and we immediately hit it off. We're both from Kansas, although I moved to Colorado when I was three. Dr. Tiller and I had a lot of things in common. We became good friends as well as colleagues. We eventually did a lot of things together, went skiing together. He invited me to his daughter's wedding, and we talked on the phone like every week or two, or several times a week. So we exchanged a lot of information about patients and our families and other activities. And I was in Boulder, he was in Wichita. So what he was doing was in a very different and in a very different context. Boulder was a very pro-choice community, and even though the anti-abortion people came after me there, I felt there was a support in the community, which increased as we went along. Dr. Tiller and I talked often about the politics of abortion, what was happening. He had a much tougher time of it than I did. And so I listened to his travails, the problems that he had in trying to protect his family and his personal life and his physical security. And we were getting some of those problems. I had five shots fired through the front of my office in 1988, and it was a clear message of disapproval. Anyway, we continued, and George and I, although our styles of work and our procedures and our ways of working and our viewpoints about what we're doing were very different in many respects, we remained friends and colleagues. And so he was shot in 1993 by an anti-abortion fanatic. On the day before he was shot, I had an editorial in the New York Times called "The Pope and My Right to Life." And I wasn't sure about the title. It should be "The Pope and I, Me and the Pope, No Hope for the Pope." I wasn't sure what the title should be. But anyway, they published it, and that day Randall Terry went on National Christian Radio Broadcasting and tried to encourage his followers to assassinate me. He had done so in front of my office several years before that. The next day, George was shot. And I had been very clear for a long time that this was a civil war. This was not a debate. This was not a conversation. This was a civil war, and the other people for a long time had been using bullets and bombs. They would accept any level of violence and stop at nothing to keep other people from doing what they wanted to do. So George's attempted assassination was a pretty important signal for me and for people on my staff. And we became very close over the time. And when he was assassinated, this was a devastating event and devastating loss for his family, first of all. Devastating loss for his patients and his colleagues. Dr. Carhart, other doctors were helping him. And it was very frightening for me and for my family. We just got back from a river trip, and this happened, and Dr. Tiller's wife called me within a couple hours after this happened. So in any case, his assassination, he didn't die, he didn't pass away, he didn't pass on, he was assassinated. This was a political assassination, has profound consequences. So that obviously profoundly affected the way we looked at things, but I think that I've been doing this for a long time, and I've continued doing it, and it's very clear that it's a very important thing to do for many reasons.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is an interview I did at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year about the documentary film After Tiller. This film tells the stories of the remaining four doctors in the country who continued to do third trimester abortions after the assassination of Dr. George Tiller by a Christian fascist anti-abortion fanatic in 2009. In the first part of the interview, I'm talking with Drs. Carhart and Hearn, two of the abortion providers featured in the film. The second part of the interview is with Martha Shane, who, together with Lana Wilson, co-directed the film After Tiller.
Dr. Carhart, what about you in relation to this? Why you think the film was important, why you wanted to participate in it?
Martha and Lana were only one of several people that approached me about doing documentaries in some aspect after Dr. Tiller's death. They were the only two, really, that seemed sincere. I mean, their hearts were in the film. I think what I took from the others, they saw this as a chance of making some money. I honestly believe that, because it was a hot topic and they could get there. But when they first called me and they said, we're thinking of doing this, would you participate? And I said, after talking for 5 minutes on the telephone, I said, I want to participate in this. I want to. And I said, but I don't want it to be about me. It's not about the ones that are carrying on. It's not about any one of the ones carrying on. You know, it's about really about the four of us. And they said, well, they were going to talk to you. They were going to talk to the girls. And at that time, the girls in New Mexico were not really really wanting to come out and talk about it. But I think as time went on and they showed them some clips of what they had done with Warren and I, they became more, at least as I remember this, it became more obvious to me that this was a winner. I really thought the way they were going about the message, they were trying to humanize us and the rest of the world, not the rest of the world, but 17% of the rest of the world have spent a lot of money and a lot of time trying to demonize us. And I just thought that it was a phenomenal...
Trying to demonize you, but also I think very, very well taken the point about, look, you guys have put your life on the line. This is something that's...
There's no day that I do not expect to be shot as I walk out of my office or walk out of my home.
Absolutely the same thing here. That, you know, am I here with some trepidation that something can happen? And the answer is, yeah, we really are. But it's just a friend of mine, when he was with me, when someone asked, you know, how do you do this every day? And the colonel, he was a colonel in the Air Force, B-52 bomber pilot, and he just looked at the other guys and said, you know, Carhart and I were in the Air Force. We joined voluntarily because we believed in the mission during Vietnam. Every day we got up, we knew people were going to try to kill us. But we went about and did our job because we believed in the mission. And I can't say it any better than that. I believe in the mission. And so did George. And I know, Warren, that's beyond point. I don't have to say it about you. He's been closer to being assassinated probably than any of us have. You know, the anti-choice are like the Taliban. They try to find suicide bombers, only the anti-choice looks for the fringe radicals, the John Salveys, the people that are going to go, they're just so far on the edge that they can convince them that they're right, and they go do it.
The main difference between, I want to reinforce what Dr. Carr had said about the Taliban. The main difference between the American anti-abortion movement and the Taliban is about 8,000 miles. They both say, do what we tell you to do or we'll kill you, and they do. There is a minor difference. The Taliban wants a fascist, Islamicist theocracy. The American anti-abortion wants a fascist, Christian theocracy. So there's a little bit of a minor difference, but this result is about the same.
Well, let me ask you this then. You know, one of the things that featured large in the film, I think, and I think even in terms of the way sometimes the questions got presented, the idea of one of the guiding lights in Dr. Tiller's life, and I think, you know, from my conversations with each of you in the past, I think this has also been a big impact on you, is his ideological and viewpoint of trust women. And this seems to be a huge thing, particularly when you're talking about the controversy around late abortion. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, George had a fondness for trying to put things in these epithets and aphorisms, and they're helpful sometimes for people to understand. My view is that this is a question of power, who has it and who doesn't. Who is best prepared to make the decision to transmit life to a new generation, the individual, the state? The woman is the expert on this subject, and it's her life that's on the line. And my view is that she's the one who should decide, make this decision. She can't make it alone because the doctor has to be involved and the other people who are helping. But she is. There's no justification for any law restricting abortion, because it's a personal medical issue and a public health issue, and this is abortion is a fundamental component of women's health care. And so I think that is sort of my much more complicated view of that. Dr. Tiller summarizes it as trust women. Well, there are some men you have to trust too, but on the other hand, I think that what that represents is that women should make that decision.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is an interview I did at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year about the documentary film After Tiller. This film tells the stories of the remaining four doctors in the country who continued to do third trimester abortions after the assassination of Dr. George Tiller by a Christian fascist anti-abortion fanatic in 2009. In the first part of the interview, I'm talking with Drs. Carhart and Hearn, two of the abortion providers featured in the film. The second part of the interview is with Martha Shane, who, together with Lana Wilson, co-directed the film After Tiller.
They murdered the doctor at church on Sunday morning. A shot sent with a warning that women don't deserve a choice. In Wichita, Kansas, which way are we going here? I'm walking through a mob of pro-lifers just to get a pap smear. It's 2009, it's legal to provide. We've come a long way. Though they're standing outside the clinic with bloody signs, old men with drawn faces, plastic fetuses. They murdered the doctor. He'd been shot before in 93. His clinic bombed in 85. For decades he'd been working for the rights of women. Rights of humanity, but he didn't take his bodyguard to church with him on Sunday. What is going on? Why is your bruise? You do not like my right to choose so much.
Welcome back. That was Kendall Winter with Dr. Tiller. Joining us now to continue talking about the film After Tiller, which is an extremely important film for everyone to see. It's an extremely powerful film. It's a riveting film, and it's one that really strikes very deeply at the heart and the brain of anybody who cares, who gives a damn about anything in the world, and in particular about women, the lives of women, and the doctors that are performing. Well, they're performing a service, a medical service, that without which women would be reduced, really, not just metaphorically, but in reality, they'd be reduced to slaves, not being able to control, have any decision over the fundamental questions of their lives. And joining us to talk about this right now is Martha Shane. Martha, welcome to the show. She's one of the co-directors of
after Tiller. Martha, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure, and we're sitting here by the pool. Well, outside it's like 0 degrees, okay? Tell me about this. Why did you make this film?
The reason why we made this film, you know, it's called After Tiller, and Dr. George Tiller was an abortion doctor in Kansas who specialized in third trimester abortions, and he was assassinated in church in 2009. And that really grabbed our attention, and we were watching sort of the media coverage of his assassination and realizing that the mainstream media really wasn't going to be able to go into who this man was, why he was doing abortions, in spite of enduring years of harassment. He had been shot before and just had daily protests at his clinic. And so we started asking, it really came from curiosity and wanting to know, who, first of all, who else is doing this work? Is there anyone left who's going to be doing this? And then what motivates someone to go to work every day when they know that their lives are being put on the line? And that's really where it came from. And then we decided to start approaching the doctors and discussing how we might be able to work with them on the film. And it ultimately was really about giving a voice to doctors who have never been given a voice, who have been forced to sort of live in the shadows.
Right, and who have been portrayed as having horns and
exactly.
And just beasts who would prey on poor women, innocent women, all this, and actually portrayed as enemies of God, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
But here's the question for you, because when you were talking about this, about the decision to make the film about the doctors, and the very real point about these doctors who, as Dr. Hearn just told me, he said, look, there's not a day I go to work that I don't fully expect to be shot when I'm walking out of the door in the afternoon. And Dr. Carhart echoed that sentiment. And I was wondering, when you decided to make this film, you focused a lot on the doctors, and it's really important in terms of, because nobody does this. Mm-hmm. Who are these people who are doing this? And there's, as you point out, there's only 4 of them in the entire country who are doing late abortions. And to me, the question is, one, did you find them eager to do this film? And then two, did you have to deal with the question of, like, if you're putting their faces out there, and how did you deal with that, even in terms of how you were thinking of how you would put it in? Because I know you were very careful about when you showed the patients as well. You know, you were very careful about how you portrayed them and the relationship between the doctor and patients, which I'll talk about in a minute, but I guess I'll stop there and let you answer.
No, that's a really good question. Yeah, so the 2 male doctors, Dr. Hearn and Dr. Carhart, got on board with the film first, and we went and we flew out and met them without any cameras or anything, and we wanted to have a discussion, you know, about what you're saying. First of all, about sort of our vision for the film, how we wanted this to be a film that would really show the world through their eyes and show the reasons why they do this work. And we also had a lot of really serious conversations about security. And I think ultimately these doctors felt like it's much more difficult to vilify someone when you understand their story, when you know that they're a normal person who, you know, with family, who may be religious or not religious, who likes photography, who writes poetry. I mean, these are very normal people in most ways who just happen to be doing a job that is incredibly, incredibly important and incredibly dangerous. So we had a lot of conversations about security, and they felt like overall that this would be a good thing for them. And we also collaborated with the National Abortion Federation as far as just making sure that there was nothing in the film that would compromise anyone's security, give away any information that people didn't want out there. And with the patients, you know, it was really about respecting their privacy, and most of the patients just felt that going back into their communities, where there's a huge amount of stigma associated with abortion in most places in this country, they felt that it was important to get these stories out there, but it was also very important for them to be able to go back to their communities and continue their lives. And that's why we made the decision, you know, we didn't show the patients' faces in the film. But I think it actually, you know, a lot of people have said that just seeing their hands and hearing their voices, it actually really expresses a lot of emotion in a sort of maybe a more poetic way. And I think people feel comfortable knowing that the patient's privacy is protected.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is an interview I did at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year about the documentary film After Tiller. This film tells the stories of the remaining four doctors in the country who continued to do third trimester abortions after the assassination of Dr. George Tiller by a Christian fascist anti-abortion fanatic in 2009. In the first part of the interview, I'm talking with Drs. Carhart and Hearn, two of the abortion providers featured in the film. The second part of the interview is with Martha Shane, who, together with Lana Wilson, co-directed the film After Tiller.
The way you captured the connection between the doctors and the patients, and very deep and very, I mean, it was really interesting, the way the doctors, you would watch the doctors' faces as they're talking to the patients, and you would listen to the patients and their voice and the quality, the character of their voices. They're telling different parts of the story, and the hands moving and scratching, you know, the thumb scratching a forefinger, and just sort of that kind of setup where it really did bring out a very, and I thought really portrayed a very important aspect of this in terms of the trust between the doctor and the patient, and the fact that the doctor was not being at all judgmental at all in any of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. I mean, the doctors are just incredible listeners. There's just a quality to their listening and an ability to listen without showing any judgment whatsoever, and that's really crucial because so many of the women who come to them, I mean, they just never expected to be in this situation, and they often get patients who have considered themselves anti-abortion. So these patients, they always consider themselves anti-abortion, maybe for religious reasons or whatever, and suddenly they find themselves in this incredibly desperate situation seeking an abortion. So they can be very conflicted. And I think, you know, the doctors are just amazing at listening to them and supporting them and, you know, making sure they're totally confident in their decision and knowing, coaching them on how to go back into their community and explain to people what happened to their pregnancy. So I just think the doctors are some of the, yeah, just incredible, incredible listeners. And as a documentary filmmaker, honestly, it was just, you know, I just feel like I learned so much from watching them, because obviously, of course, listening is very important in my job as well. And they're the best models for that.
Now, the assassination of Dr. Tiller, mm-hmm. you were saying, had a big part in deciding to do this film. Mm-hmm. But were you active in abortion rights before this?
No, you know, I was never personally active in abortion rights. I think, you know, like a lot of people who grew up post Roe versus Wade, I always basically took it for granted that I could have an abortion, that if I ever was to have an unplanned pregnancy, that that would be an option. And I definitely, you know, felt strongly that that should be an option for everyone. But I hadn't really thought deeply about the abortion issue until I started working on this film, and particularly third trimester abortion. I think, like many people going into this, even people who are very, very well-educated about reproductive health in general, I didn't know the reasons why women would seek a third trimester abortion, and very few people do. You know, there's just a severe lack of information out there about the reasons why women seek these abortions. So I think I was coming from sort of a similar place to where most of our audience will come from. And also feeling like, you know, in my generation, I think people have sort of become a little bit alienated from the abortion debate because it is a bit of a shouting match, and it seems so polarized, and like it's difficult, you know, to sort of find any consensus or have a more sort of nuanced and complicated debate about it. And I think with this film, we wanted to really show the gray area and get sort of beyond the politics, because at heart, you know, these are doctors who their goal is to prevent suffering, and these are women from all backgrounds who are in incredibly desperate situations, and they're the ones who are best able to speak about this subject, and they speak about it in a complex way.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is an interview I did at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year about the documentary film After Tiller. This film tells the stories of the remaining four doctors in the country who continued to do third trimester abortions after the assassination of Dr. George Tiller by a Christian fascist anti-abortion fanatic in 2009. In the first part of the interview, I'm talking with Drs. Carhart and Hearn, two of the abortion providers featured in the film. The second part of the interview is with Martha Shane, who, together with Lana Wilson, co-directed the film After Tiller.
Well, let me ask you this, because, yes. You know, and part of it, I think actually, particularly when you look at the situation that's going mm-hmm. on today, mm-hmm. I'll tell you, right now it's not even a question so much of two sides shouting at each other.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, I think in my mind, polarization is good because oftentimes that's the way things get cleared up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, I'll tell you just truthfully, I'm so sick and tired of the let's reach across and find common ground.
Right.
Because when
you
get common ground, inevitably, in the mm-hmm. question of abortion, inevitably, when you seek common ground, the abortion rights and the pro-abortion side loses.
Mm-hmm,
you know, and this is and these people that are out there. You know, these, and I know you were very careful about how you portrayed the anti-abortion people, but, you know, frankly, in my mind, they're fascistic and dangerous.
Right.
And when they're out there and they're doing all these things and, you know, they're rolling along and there's a full-scale assault on abortion on every front.
Mm-hmm.
The legal front, you know, the right to abortion is becoming narrower and narrower.
Yes.
It's disappearing. Mm-hmm. Roe v. Wade is disappearing.
Right.
And then everything else that goes around that. I mean, the 90 laws passed in the last year.
Right.
You know, this kind of stuff is terrible. And so for people to really be able to understand this, I think, in my mind, I think things really do need to get sharpened up. And that's one of the things I appreciated deeply about your film was that one of the ways you did that was by taking on this horned devil image
exactly,
of the doctors.
Exactly.
And showing them and showing the patients and where was the need coming from.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's really true. Like you say, in the past 2 years, more anti-abortion legislation has been passed than ever before. And I think it's really easy for people to, you know, there's this wave of 20-week abortion bans that have been, there's nine states now that have passed them and more that are considering them. And I think, you know, a lot of people think, oh, 20 weeks, you know, that's fine. Like, a lot of people just don't think about what that means to women. And I think by, you know, showing the reasons why women are seeking these later abortions, people will understand how important it is to have that option available. And then also, just to speak to what you were saying about sort of the doctors being portrayed as these villains, as these devils, you know, there's just so much, again, so much misinformation out there about, you know, there are people in, you know, Nebraska, for example, which is a place where, you know, it's a very anti-abortion state. And there are protesters outside the clinic there who truly believe that the walls of the clinic are splattered with blood and that these doctors are villains. And I think just by going inside the clinic and showing them that that is not the case, you know, I really hope that we're going to be able to clear up some of those really really horrible depictions of the doctors and just show that these are people like anyone else who are just extremely dedicated to their patients. And I think almost anyone, you know, I was talking to someone earlier, just said that, you know, the average length of time that a patient is allowed to speak before a doctor interrupts them on a regular medical visit is about 8 seconds. And with these doctors, as you see in the film, They speak to the patients at length, and the patients, they listen incredibly well. This should be the model for medical care in this country. These are experts who are at the top of their fields and just incredibly good at dealing with patients and listening to them and their concerns.
Well, plus, I think that, you know, the biggest factor for me is really, I mean, look, these are people who have moved into, and all four of them, you know, and the fact that it's, I mean, the other thing that comes out in your film, the fact that there are only four of them, they're all very old, and, you know, what the hell is going to happen? I mean, you know, most medical schools today do not provide training for just normal abortions, you know, and let alone late abortions. And the fact that this is what's happening in relation to abortion, what's happening to these doctors in particular, what happened to Dr. Tiller, the whole idea that that's part of this thing of the demonization. And there's a real chance that after a certain period of time, there won't be anyone providing, at least not that we know of, providing late abortions.
Yeah, that's something that the doctors are all really, really aware of. And like you say, these doctors are getting older. And between that and between this recent wave of legislation that's banning abortion after 20 weeks, you know, third trimester abortion is on the verge of becoming illegal or inaccessible or both. And I think all of the doctors are really aware that of the need to train younger doctors to do this. And there's a doctor that is now being trained who's actually 35 years old, so far younger than the doctors in the film. And she's being trained to do these abortions in Albuquerque. So that's one person who's coming along. But of course, there's many more needed. And all of the doctors are always looking for people who are interested in training, but it is very difficult to find people who are willing to put their lives on the line. whose families are willing to have them do such dangerous work, and who also are able to deal with such emotionally fraught, such an emotionally fraught situation, and counsel the patients.
Let me sneak in one question before they drag you away from
it. Okay.
Real quick, do you see any connection between what's happening with abortion and the overall climate that's being generated, the glorification and basically the normalization of rape, you know, as we see it in what's happening in India and what happened in Steubenville, Ohio, you know, where this young, I don't know if you know about the case, but this 16-year-old woman was, you know, drunk, passed out, and was raped repeatedly by the football team, you know, and dragged from party to party and continually assaulted. So this question of what's happening with abortion, what's happening with the pornography industry becoming a $1 billion industry or more, mm-hmm. and the normalization of rape in the climate, and anti-woman climate mm-hmm. in society. Do you see them, any kind of common connection there in terms of, say, even like the dehumanization of women, for instance?
Yes, I mean, definitely. I think there's, you know, there's a huge connection there between what we saw in the last election with, you know, having a debate over what is legitimate rape. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable that we're having that conversation. And of course it plays into sort of women's rights. And I think, you know, one thing that we really want to get across with this film is that, you know, if you don't want there to be abortions, the key to that, to making that happen, is to make sex education and contraception available to all women, and to really educate women so that they're able to speak out and able to be agents for themselves. And I think, yes, it's really important to educate women about the power that they do hold and to empower them around these issues. So,
Martha, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And we've just been talking with Martha Shane, the co-director of the film After Tiller, as well as the two of the doctors that are featured in the film, Dr. Carhart and Dr. Hearn. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Revolution Nothing Less. So stay tuned.
Woman is the nigger of the world. Yes, she is. Think about it. Woman is the nigger of the world. Think about it. Do something about it. We make her paint her face and dance. If she won't be a slave, we say that she don't love us.
Welcome back. That was John Lennon with Woman is the Nigger of the World. Well, we've just been talking about the assault on abortion rights and the assault on women and the dehumanization and degradation of women that's part of this system and can only be solved by revolution. And here to talk about that and dig into that more is Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this is a segment of a film of a speech that Avakian gave back in the fall of 2012 called BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. And this segment is called The Oppression of Women Bound Up with This System, A Driving Force for Revolution.
Now, earlier I spoke to the fact of the division of society into masters and slaves, into different classes, developed together with the oppression of women. These were very tightly bound together in their historical development and have remained so throughout the course of history since that time through different kinds of societies. And today we can see the ways in which the oppression of women, not just in a particular country, but on a world scale, continues to feed the functioning of this capitalist imperialist system. Not only, as I pointed out, is it highly profitable in the billions and billions of dollars to oppress women in sex trafficking, prostitution, and pornography, but also the backward conditions that are maintained and enforced by the functioning and the military power of the imperialist countries throughout the Third World lead to a situation where many women are outcast and desperate and highly vulnerable to being exploited in this vast network of sweatshops that is at the foundation of imperialist capital in the world today. You know, I think of the phenomenon of people standing in line for the latest gadget from Apple. And I have to say, it makes me mad. I say to myself, what the f*** is the matter with you people? You can stand in line overnight for the latest gadget from Apple, but you can't stand up to oppose wars and torture and mass incarceration and the degradation of women. What the hell is the matter with you people? Now, to be clear, those people standing in line are not the enemy. But what is represented by Apple, and not just Apple unto itself, but the whole system and the network of exploitation that Apple is a part of and enmeshed in, is what needs to be swept aside. I mean, when you're at the end of the food chain in a country like this, living parasitically, even if you're not in the ruling class, off of people all over the world, once again, sometimes all this can be hidden from you. You do not see the blood and the bones, the worn down fingers and other body parts of particularly women who are working in the plants in places like China, making the components that go into the Apple products and all these other things under horrific conditions. You do not see the people in Bangladesh making many of the clothes that you're wearing. And when you leave here and go home tonight, look in your closet and see how many of your clothes you can find are not made in the third world, and you can be sure if they are made in places like Bangladesh, Haiti, Pakistan, or whatever, that they're made through a lot of child labor and, in any case, extreme conditions of sweatshop exploitation. But we do not, the products don't come with this stamped on them. You don't pick up an iPhone, press a button, and the blood of the women who made it comes gushing out. But it's there, even though you can't see it. And imperialism feasts on this. Don't let them fool you with their talk about microloans. Let's have some microloans for poor women in the third world so they can set up a business and exploit other women and then, in their large numbers, fail anyway. This is not what the imperialist system is doing. This is a tiny countercurrent to the massive exploitation on which of these very kinds of women on which this system rests. And look at this country. Not only is there the great value to imperialist capital of super exploitation of women in the third world, but in this country, it's a fact that the social relations that oppress women are critical for holding together this whole oppressive system, which has historically evolved with male domination, a key foundation of the whole system, a foundation stone built into its whole structure. Think about the family and how people live and reproduce in this society. Everything in this society is based on commodity production and exchange. You don't have little groups of people all making overwhelmingly the things they need and then using them themselves. There's vast networks of exploitation in this country, but increasingly in other parts of the world, producing all these things. And then you have to get some means by working in some way or other to have the basis of to have the commodity money to go buy these things. That's the way the economy works. And all of it gets funneled through the what these reactionaries are always reminding us is the basic unit and cell of this society, the family. And the whole family has evolved historically with women being subordinate to men and having as one part of that the prime responsibility for the domestic aspect of things, including the rearing of children and things like just doing the everyday work of the house. And there have been some changes in this society. More women in the professions, more women going to college, more women working in a lot of ways. And all this has put tremendous strains on these oppressive relations, but it hasn't broken them because this system cannot do without these relations. And so you have this tremendous potential eruption where the changes in the economy are straining against the limitations of the oppression of women and other exploitative and oppressive relations, but the system cannot do without them. Now, as one illustration of this, I was reading an article in the New York Times about a phenomenon in the South where some of these men who had fairly good-paying industrial jobs, once again the phenomenon, the companies closed down, move the factories away, the men are out of work, the women are going out and getting the jobs and service and whatever that are available to them that they can get, but the men are largely sitting on their couches, drinking their beer and moping. And one of the author of this article asked one of these men, well, why don't you go out and get one of these jobs that these women are doing? He said, no, I can't do that. It's not man's work. I just wouldn't feel like a man if I had a job like that. This captures a lot about the contradictions of this system and how it's intensifying. And in reading this, I was thinking about what Engels wrote in The Origin of the Family, Private Property in the State, and talking about the Roman Empire, Engels, who along with Marx founded the communist movement. He was talking about agriculture in the declining period of the Roman Empire, that it had been based on slave plantations called latifundia. But as the Roman Empire went into decline, the plantations, the slave plantations, the latifundia became less and less profitable. And so they broke down and people had to go back into small-scale farming. But all of the former slave owners, or almost all of them, wouldn't go back and do actual farm work, even though the plantations were no longer profitable, because they considered it beneath their dignity to do that kind of work. And Engels pointed out this contributed to the decline and weakening of Rome and made it more and more vulnerable to the barbarians that were increasingly at the gate and battering at the gate. And I was thinking about these men saying, I can't do that. It's not man's work. It doesn't make me feel like a man. How this represents a straining of the changes have brought about, straining against the oppressive relations. And I was thinking about how, in parallel to Rome, how this could also contribute to the further declining and weakening of this oppressive system and make it more vulnerable to the barbarians, namely us. Now, the oppression of women and all the horrors bound up with it can be ended and something radically different and emancipating brought into being. Now, let's be honest. To many, especially many women, this may not seem possible and, frankly, hard to believe. But that is not only because of the way things are now and the way so many men act so much of the time, but more fundamentally, because of the way things are now, sets a certain framework and tone for people's thinking. Because the possibility of radical change cannot be seen to the degree that our vision and our sense of reality and of possibility is still confined within, conditioned by, and filtered through the dominating relations that are at the foundation of this whole system. And the traditions, values, ways of being and of thinking that constantly pour forth from and serve to perpetuate this system that we are forced to live under. In this way, they get us twice. Their system embodies and enforces all this horrific oppression, and it has people believing that this cannot be done away with. But the truth, which they try every way to keep people from seeing, is that we can be rid of this horrific oppression. But we can't do this by accepting the terms of this system or any part of its oppression. We can't do it half-stepping and halfway. That is why Basics 322 makes it very clear. You cannot break all the chains except one. You cannot say you want to be free of exploitation and oppression except you want to keep the oppression of women by men. You can't say you want to liberate humanity, yet keep one half of humanity enslaved to the other half. The oppression of women is completely bound up with the division of society into masters and slaves, exploiters and exploited, and the ending of all such conditions is impossible without the complete liberation of women. All this is why women have a tremendous role to play, not only in making revolution, but in making sure there is all the way revolution. The fury of women can and must be fully unleashed as a mighty force for proletarian revolution. And as this statement is also emphasizing, the fight against the oppression of women and for all the way revolution is not just their fight. It is a fight that must be fully and vigorously taken up by men as well, by everyone who really wants to see an end to this system and all the horrors it means for the masses of humanity. Everyone who wants to see an end to the long night in which humanity has been divided into masters and slaves, exploiters and exploited, who wants to see a dawning of a new day for humanity. The only people who should fear and not join in with this unleashed fury of women are those who have a real stake in this system and want to keep it going with everything it does to people.
All right, once again, that's Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and that's a segment from his speech, the film of a speech he gave, called B.A. Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. And the title of that chapter of the film is The Oppression of Women, Bound Up with the System, a Driving Force for Revolution. You can check out all of Bob Avakian's works and various other things and all about the movement for revolution by going to the site revcom.us. And you can also find information there about end pornography and patriarchy, the enslavement and degradation of women, including this special edition of Revolution newspaper called A Declaration for Women's Liberation and the Emancipation of All Humanity. We're going to be real quick going out. I want to thank my assistant producer, Annie Day, and Henry Carson. I want to thank my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And just before we leave you, we've got a few announcements real quick. We're going to go out now with a little bit of Rebel Girl from Bikini Kill.